Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis and Chuck Thurston. Hi, guys.
Hey, hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Marvin is babysitting today. It's a nice day. Yeah.
I'm not even sure where he is. Do we even know? Is he in Colorado or is he in Washington?
Oh, boy, I think he's in Washington.
Okay, he's up there.
Because he said he's watching two grandchildren, I think. So, you know, he's...
Yes, he is.
He's following on in that in a great tradition of family life, watching your grandchildren. What a joy that is. Yeah. I love it.
Well, that's wonderful, yeah. Yeah. I look forward to those days. Speaking
I know
to
you,
you know,
do,
I'm the only co-host without grandchildren. If my children are listening to this, I'm saying again, I'm the only co-host here without grandchildren. Just letting you know.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Really
I think of our dear friends Buck and Arlene who waited very, very long to have one, and then they are you still there? I'm getting a strange message that says you are not connected. Please call in.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think
I can hear you.
Hold on, I'm gonna call back in so that the show doesn't end, or maybe I'll wait for a second and hope that here he is. He came back. Okay, good. Andre, are you back?
Yeah. The poor man the poor man tried to mute himself and really muted himself.
No.
Muted yourself out of existence.
Yes.
Well, here's for your kids.
That.
Make that man a grandfather.
Yeah, exactly.
Put those buttons a little farther apart.
You know, I do have. I'm reassured all the time. But Dad, you have grandpuppies, you know, and so this is like some kind of solace. It is very cold, if fuzzy, solace for me.
A cold and fuzzy solace, huh?
Yeah.
Grand puppies. Yeah.
They're sweet dogs, but they're not the same. They're not the same.
I can't
put my finger on them exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not the same.
Yeah. Well,
but,
I'm just starting down that path.
Oh, your little grandson is so beautiful.
Yeah, yeah,
oh, my
yeah.
gosh. So bright and present.
We do these FaceTime calls. And, I think he's starting to recognize me over FaceTime. Wow. I mean, crazy to think about that compared to not that long ago when something like that would not even be in the realm of imagination.
Well, that's true. It's so much better that at least we have that,
it's
if we can't
yeah.
be,
okay.
yeah, if we can't be there personally. I think of it as, I think of communications in that way dimensionally that, to write to somebody an email or something, that's one dimension. To actually pick up the phone and call them, that's two dimensions because now you can hear their thoughts and their voice, right? To see them on a Zoom call or a Face call is three because now you can hear their thoughts, hear their voice, and see their face, right? And see somewhat of their body language. But the most high definition would be to be in their presence and be with them personally, be able to touch them. Mm. Now you're adding another sense, the sense of touch.
Mm.
And
that'll be nice.
But
thinking about, like little Orion growing up with this, he's never known a time when
that sort
of interaction wasn't part of his experience, right? So I just wonder what that, as a metaphor, having that experience of seeing another person at a remote location on a little screen, right, where you can interact is, it's a, kind of takes the mind into a frame, you might say, that didn't even exist. Not that long ago, like I was saying. So I
That's
just wondering
true.
How that, what, in terms of like thinking about God, right? It's like God is a person. I mean, you think about the Father of Paradise, a person at a distance, right? But yet that sort of the presence is always with us. It's beamed out through all reality. So we have that same kind of, or especially like the Spirit of Truth or the Holy Spirit. We have that same capacity to experience another personality at a distance, or that's with us even, but is not visible. But having that experience, in other words, what I'm wondering is if that will prepare the mind in an interesting way in terms of its acceptance of the presence of deity, the invisible presence of deity.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Well, I've been equating to life, I shouldn't say lately because I have thought this for a long time, but it just occurred to me recently that our unseen helpers are not unlike mother and father are when you're in utero, right? And all of your friends and all of your relatives and everybody that's waiting for you to make your debut into the world, on your birthday. And what a joyful occasion that is. And I'm thinking of the transition into the next life in those terms, that the angels are like that. They're waiting for us to make that debut into that next realm where we can see them. I mean, a baby can't see his parents until he's born, right? And he can't see grandma and grandpa and brother and sister. But he makes that transition through the birth process into this world, and it's another higher transition, a similar process into the next one where we'll be able to see the cosmic family, the family of God. And what a powerful what a powerful revelation that will be when we see our angels
brilliant
smiling
analogy,
at us.
Paula. Brilliant. Yeah.
And with a new body.
Yeah. Yeah,
similar
with a whole new,
and that was actually,
a whole new set of sensations, a new mind, a new body, a new being. You know, not death adds nothing to us, but the knowledge that we survived it. But then, wow, what a powerful experience that must be. That's one of the
experiences. That's kind of a big one.
Yeah, that's a big one.
You would think. you would think.
Yeah. You'll never
nothing
forget
to be
that
taken
one.
For granted. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Nothing to be taken for granted.
Your analogy is brilliant for the angels. I mean, you've given me a new way to think about my angels as being, you know, just really outside the womb. You know, knowing my better self is in the womb, and me sort of, you know, guessing at what's it like out there, you know? The older I get, the less I know about what the next life is about. I don't care how much I've read the Aranch book. I mean, and I've read it over and over. You know, it's at this point now, my imagination, it's starting to fail me in terms of, though there are certain things that I imagine, of course, you know, there are certain details that I wonder, that would be interesting, the pearly gates, you know, surrounding circles of the suns, you know, on Gerasim is where we find out we have the pearly gates, right? And there are many, many of them. But still, the imagination fails. And what it really fails me regarding is it fails me regarding just how we will be engaged with each other, with the angels, with everybody. How different a sense of who we are we will begin to have right away. That's what floors me. Because we're going to be soul people.
We are.
You know, this animal stuff, you know, the crude stuff that has been automatically and mechanically coming up will no longer be automatically and mechanically coming up. The stuff that we'll be getting over will be the residual, the habits we formed as a result of having been in animal bodies and needing to disabuse ourselves of some of our habits of thinking and feeling and executing, you know. We're going
to
have to learn to do things differently.
You think?
Yes. I mean, those are the vestigial traits for one thing, but they say the last ones are not gone until the seventh mansion world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the finishing. You know, we say about discovering who we are, at the same time we're going to be discovering what we are in a whole new way as well. And your analogy, Paula, I'm just thinking some more about that. Just the fact that we're in a physical existence on this world. We're in a physical body and we have all the limitations of physical. That's what prevents us from seeing the angels, right? So it's our physical nature that is actually very womb-like, if you think about it. And on the mansion world, we'll no longer be in a physical body. I mean, it'll be a Marantia body, which is...
Well, right. But it's still the progressional womb. It's because I think the way I look at it is we're still in that womb-like space all the way until we can actually be born as a full-fledged spirit being, which means nothing physical to contain our beingness.
What about Marantia? Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah,
but that's
right.
That's a little
so
weird.
It's a long gestation.
Right.
But
one.
at least we'll be able to, you know, see and have those extra senses and be able to perceive our, you know, all of these marvelous beings and feel their love.
Yeah.
Not that we can't feel that now. We can begin to start to tap into that. But to feel it I don't know. That's what I hone in on. I hone in on those relationships and how it will feel. What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I say that
it begins, you say? Yeah, right.
Yeah, that begins with the first national, of course. You know, especially being able to see our angels. That's going to be such a thing. I can't imagine what that's going to be like.
I don't know. It's a good thing that you aren't in a human body, because I think my heart would explode.
Yeah, right.
But,
anyway.
And
anyway,
just by
like,
the way, go ahead, Chuck, finish your thought.
Oh, I was going to say, it's kind of like that cuteness thing you were talking about last week.
Yeah.
In the eyes of the angels, they're kind of watching us swimming around in this physical reality. And on some level, they must regard us as being pretty cute, in spite of all our foibles.
Yeah, I think that.
And they can't wait to, like, hold us. You know, like, that's the thing, after a baby is born, then you can hold it, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be kind of like that on the nationals, I think. And maybe not literally, but sort of. You know, the fact that we can have real time interaction, we can be sort of held within the consciousness of the angels in a whole new way. And we can hold them, too.
Yes.
You know, holding
and what a labor of love that is.
Yeah.
What a labor of love it is to get to know. When you carry a child and the mother and father and all the loved ones experiences, right, the anticipation of the birth of that child because of the very thing you said, you can get to hold it and see it. And, oh, look, he has dimples.
Yeah.
And, oh, my God, the color of his eyes. And,
right.
Isn't he so beautiful and perfect? And now we get to teach him everything. And I think they have that same joy now that they can literally guide you and teach you and, you know, reach you. And it's no more a mystery. The mystery is gone in that regard. And now it's fully out in the open. They're real. And they love you.
Yeah, right.
And they're your guides. They're here to show you the ropes here in this new, you know, in this new world.
Yeah.
Show you how to navigate.
We're kind of largely dependent on imagination for a lot of this.
True.
Now, and I think imagination is an interesting tool almost that we've been given, because it can touch on the reality of what you're imagining in terms of, like, presence, for example. You know, our ability to make contact with the presence of deity. How will we do that? Mm-hmm. You're growing our ability to feel the presence of God, you know, like Jesus talks about. There's a kind of a role in there for imagination that sort of opens the gateway.
How else could you tap into it?
To the mind's accepting of the possibility. You have to accept the possibility first, right?
Right.
And the imagination, I think, plays a positive role in that.
Right.
I mean, there's the intellectual, philosophical, you know, underpinning of belief level of that, but to actually really experience that as a reality, it takes it to another level beyond just belief or theory. It's like a real experience, which is, you know, I think Jesus was encouraging us to develop. Anyway.
Yeah, Perry on the board said, perhaps we sometimes get to hear our celestial family sing to us. And I love that, Perry. And it reminds me, it reminds me of a story that, you know, remember when the internet was new and what we loved to do was not so political all the time. It was, we loved to make each other laugh and inspire each other. And so we shared heartwarming and humorous stories a lot. Do you remember that? Because that, every single day I would get a joke or a heartwarming story from somebody in my email, you know, and it was so wonderful. And I started saving them. And in fact, when we launched Truthbook, we put them all up on truthbook.com, those heartwarming and humorous stories. And we just kept collecting them and putting them up. And now that's one of the most visited pages on Truthbook. But there was a story in there about a little a woman who was pregnant a family, you know, mom and dad were pregnant, and they had a little son who was like 3 years old, and every day he would sing "You Are My Sunshine" to his unborn baby sister. And then when she was born, she had some issues, and she was not thriving, and she was in really, really serious trouble. And the doctors thought that she was going to die. In fact, they fully expected her to. And her mom begged them to let her little brother come in and see her because he wanted to. He wanted to see her, and more importantly, he wanted to sing to her. And when they finally agreed that, you know, the little brother could come in and see her, he started singing to her, and everything changed after that moment. And she started to thrive. And, you know, I think that the experience of being in utero is very, very real. And they do hear our voices, though muffled. They do hear our
song. Yeah, of course.
And I think it's true, Perry. We do hear the faint echo of their love, their, you know, love songs to us and their lullabies. And sometimes I think I feel their touch, you know, just like I remember little May when she was little. We went to had an experience with an angel of a church, and it was like this life-altering experience because I realized that the angels of the churches are like guardians, and they're physically there, they're physically present, and they guard a congregation. They're like a group guardian, and they guard that congregation, and they view and witness every loving act of worship and every joyful song and every marriage and birth and death, and they joy with that congregation, and they're there for many years. Some churches are very old, 300, 400, 500, 600 and beyond years old. An angel of that church has been guarding it all that time, and that was such a revelation to me, because I thought of the angels of the churches as more like a council on high somewhere, not such a personal ministry to congregations. And so when we went to this little church, that happened, by the way, to me at an old Episcopal church in New York City. It was it dated 300 years old, I think. And I had that, we were meditating in there, and that, bam, that happened. I had a vision that was very, very powerful. And so when we went to Mexico City one day, or not Mexico City, we went to Mexico on vacation. May was about 7, and we went into a little church that was part of a little group of shops. It was just another one of a little group of shops, but you walked in there was about 8 pews, 4 on either side, and there were little religious artifacts around on a shelf along the top of the wall, and a beautiful little altar. And we walked in and immediately felt the presence of the angel in there. And Glenn and May and I were all holding hands. And we started to vibrate. I mean, it was just like, it was so, the presence, her presence was so real. We all felt it. And we were speechless. And I looked over at them, and I could see, you know, one was on one side, one was on the other, and I could see that they were feeling it too. And I said, "Do you feel that?" And all they could do was nod. They couldn't even speak. It was so powerful. And I said, "That's the presence. That's the angel of this church. She's saying hello to us. She's greeting us." And about, you know, a couple months later, little Maymay was at home, and she said to me, "Mommy, I just felt an angel." And I said, "How do you know, honey?" And she said, "She tickled me down my back." And I understand that. I sometimes feel that. I completely understand that. They let you know. They let you know their presence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's especially more you know, obvious when you believe in them, right? That's the first step. So if you're thinking about them, they can.
Including that. as a, just part of one sense of reality that we have. We have these companion spirits with us.
I know.
It does change. I mean, it changes how you think about everything. To begin to open the mind to those possibilities. And you know, make them real.
And I know.
Experience by whatever we can do from our end, you know, to interact.
Right.
To offer ourselves into an interaction, even if the presence we're interacting with is not visible to our eyes. There's this, you know, they say that personality has this capacity to sense other personality. You know, that's in that list of characteristics or observations they've made about personality where they say, you know, we can't define personality. We've noticed some things. And one of the things they noticed.
But we've noticed some things, yeah.
Personality can sense the presence of another personality independent of anything else. At least that's the implication that I took from that comment. If you know the one I'm talking about, in the personality survival paper.
Yeah, if you can find it, that would be great.
Yeah, here it is. It's right here. It's in the opening section. So, yeah, personality, this is number 11. Personality responds directly to other personality present.
Mm. Yeah.
That's it.
There you go.
So that,
there you
that
go.
Idea that personality, we can respond simply to the presence of another personality directly. And that's how a lot of our relationship with God develops, I think, is in the same way. We begin to sense the presence of the personality of God, or Jesus, you know, and the Mother Spirit.
Right.
And that our, right. that's inherent in having personality, is the capacity to do that. And it doesn't depend on sight. It doesn't depend on hearing. It doesn't depend on any of our physical senses, apparently, is what they're saying. That it's a direct response. It's just part of what is the nature of personality.
Would you say
so
that's perception, Chuck?
What's
you
that?
Perceive it? Is it perception,
well,
do you think?
Well, they say responds directly to other personality presence. So in a sense, yeah, in a sense.
Yeah.
I mean, that feeling you were just describing, like being in that little church or, you know,
right.
your daughter's story.
Feeling the energy of another person.
Feeling their presence,
Yeah, feeling their presence, right. It is, it's subtle but real, yeah.
I mean, the presence is definitely there. It's just our experience of that is limited, or our capacity to experience that feels limited. But it may be not as limited as we think if we choose to develop that, you know, just by remembering even. Yeah, God is with
right.
me. Wow. You know. Or
tuning in to
yeah.
yeah. Maybe that's what meditation is.
Well,
you're
to refresh one's memory, the realization, maybe is a better word for it,
mm-hmm.
of other presence. Mm-hmm. It's not
right.
you know, inside our head. That's the thing that gets tricky.
Well, right.
Voices inside our heads. You got to be careful about that. But but even the adjuster, you know, the adjuster is within us, but they're very careful about pointing out that the adjuster's nature is pre-personal, which is such an, you know, that's just down a whole nother path. But it just amazes me that we have all of these endowments of deity presence that are with us all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter
to
of
greater
us,
and greater degrees.
Up.
The
yeah,
further we go down the road.
Yeah. That's one of the ways we grow is in our ability for that to all become more real.
Yeah.
Kind of in our experience. Not just something we read in the book, but, you know, it's like, wow, the book talked about, that's actually real. And that's the idea, you know, of revelation. You know, you're asking what you mean, revelation. It does reveal. It reveals the things that we would never discover on our own, which is what's so fascinating and exciting about it.
Wow.
And this whole thing about
that's so true.
Yeah, this kind of ministry we're talking about is part of that.
Well, welcome to the cosmic family of God, right? Welcome to the
exactly.
Welcome to the family with a capital T and a capital F, you know, the
mm-hmm.
family.
Mm-hmm.
And
human,
you know,
superhuman.
Yeah, and that's, I think, in itself, what a powerful revelation that is when you finally realize that we're all part of his family and her family, their family,
mm-hmm.
the original family. Marvin loves to point that out, and I'm so glad he does because, you know, the more we hear it, the more we start to realize our responsibility within that family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even the Trinity is like a little family.
Yeah. The original, they're the original family. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The family of families, the source family.
Mm-hmm.
That brings into being all other family members and, you know.
All right, and then we have Michael and the Mother Spirit. That's like much closer to home. Easier
right.
in some ways to conceptualize their role as parents and to us, literally.
You know, someone, I think it was Janet Farrington Graham, who is such an advocate of family life and such a great mom and such a great person, you know. And we were talking about family as mothers often do, and she was telling me about, you know, how important it was to her early on to teach her children how to serve within their family, and that it wasn't a duty, that the service wasn't chores or whatever. It was service. And it's service you give to your family. And you give it to your family because you're a member of your family and you want to serve your family for the common welfare of the family, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that
mm-hmm.
it's a joyful thing, not an obligation, or, you know. And I just was so touched by that. What a wonderful way to teach children about service is the little things they do for their own family
mm-hmm.
is the beginning of that.
Right, reframing the chores.
Right, right. And making them service, making
you know,
them a loving service.
Doing the dishes, you know, that's a high service. And in a way it is. So many chores can seem so mundane, but they have to be done.
But
right? Somebody's got to do it.
Right, but they are actually a loving service.
The way you're talking about it, then you can enter into it with a, you know, a higher sense of what it's all about.
Right, right.
And then they can carry that over into the world. You know, the chores of the world also have to get done.
Right.
And right. having a more of a higher spirit sort of, you know, understanding or way of engaging with that. Just lightens everything up in so many ways.
Yeah. It's like Jesus telling his mom to smile, right? They were all so hard-pressed after Joseph died, and it was just such a tragic thing, and baby Ruth was
mm-hmm.
born after that, and, you know, they had a lot.
Yeah.
They suffered real human, you know, tragedy and need. And, And he said, you know, Mother Mary, smile. You know, we'll all be encouraged by your smile to carry on. And he was reminding her how important her encouragement is to the rest of the family.
Uh-huh.
It's lovely
the way they say that. I don't know if I can find that one.
What, that
quote?
Oh,
yeah, here it is. Yeah, here, I'll just read this one paragraph.
Okay.
That comes up.
Give us the reference on that, too.
It's 7, section 3, paragraph 14. So this, I guess he was probably 18 at the time. Anyway, because for 4 years, their standard of living had steadily declined. Year by year, they felt the pinch of increasing poverty. By the close of this year, they faced one of the most difficult experiences of all their uphill struggles. James had not yet begun to earn much, and the expenses of a funeral on top of everything else. Oh, is this one of the children died? Little Amos.
Baby,
yeah.
Amos, maybe? Yeah.
Right, died. Right, right. After a week's illness with a high fever. Oh, my God. Forgot about that. Okay. James had not yet begun to earn much, and the expenses of a funeral on top of everything else staggered them. Expression. But Jesus would only say to his anxious and grieving mother, Mother Mary, sorrow will not help us. We are all doing our best, and Mother's smile, perchance, might even inspire us to do better. Day by day, we are strengthened for these tasks by our hope of better days ahead. His sturdy and practical optimism was truly contagious. All the children lived in an atmosphere of anticipation of better times and better things. And this hopeful courage contributed mightily to the development of strong and noble characters in spite of the depressiveness of their poverty.
Isn't that beautiful?
And then I just got to read this next paragraph about Jesus. they say that Jesus possessed the ability effectively to mobilize all his powers of mind, soul, and body on the task immediately in hand. He could concentrate his deep thinking mind on the one problem which he wished to solve. And this, in connection with his untiring patience, enabled him serenely to endure the trials of a difficult mortal existence, to live as if he were, quote, seeing him who is invisible. Funny, that's what we were just talking about. But, yeah,
wow.
to live as if he were seeing him who is invisible. So that was and it's interesting how they talk about that being contagious. In
yeah.
the family.
We all might be inspired.
Truly contagious. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, to think of him with us, you know, if you're going through a hard time, imagine Jesus is with you. Imagine, you know, there's a way
right.
to open up the experience and then realize that he brings this with him, this kind of attitude that's contagious, right? You can still
reminds you to smile. He's
yeah.
reminding you
yeah,
to
right.
smile
right.
and be a good cheer.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, he's a cheerful companion. He's a cheerful companion.
Right.
You can feel
oh,
that
a,
in this, too. Yeah.
The
gift.
Beauty of these teachings is it gives us him back, right? It gives us this. It gives us Jesus
yeah.
the Father, and we know uh-huh. him now. We know his
right.
fatherly love. And we can tap into it because
yeah.
we know it. We recognize it. It's like, you know, it's like when you get to know somebody, then you recognize them. You know,
right.
it's the same
yeah.
thing.
You
we know him now and we recognize him.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Well, Andre, mm-hmm. you haven't said anything. What do you think? I should say we're going to read the last section of paper 84, Marriage and Family Life. It's section 8, The Dangers of Self-Gratification. So it should be really interesting, I think. But do you have any other thoughts,
maybe
Andre?
Maybe an air quote.
Yeah, revealing.
You know, I just wanted
let's see, it's interesting.
Get to our standard 40-minute preamble, and we're just about there. So. Let's read that. Those dangers of self-gratification. You know,
yeah.
which as soon as I hear that, I immediately it's followed by and lions and tigers and bears. Oh my!
Oh my!
yeah.
Yeah. It's like dun dun dun.
Yeah.
The dangers of self-gratification.
Okay, who's the author? Who's the author? Oh, Chief of Seraphim. Okay, well, she knows where
well,
she weeks.
Yep, yep, exactly. So, who wants to read that?
Feel like
Andre.
Break my silence. The dangers
go
of
ahead, Andre.
Gravitation.
Yay.
Now, let me make sure I've got my phone properly positioned.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Better.
You're coming
much
in.
The
good
dangers
now.
Of
yeah.
self-gratification. Just keeping you all in suspense. The great threat against family life is the menacing rising tide of self-gratification, the modern pleasure mania. The prime incentive to marriage used to be economic. Sex attraction was secondary. Marriage, founded on self-maintenance, led to self-perpetuation and concomitantly provided one of the most desirable forms of self-gratification. It is the only institution of human society which embraces all three of the great incentives for living. Originally, property was the basic institution of self-maintenance, while marriage functioned as the unique institution of self-perpetuation. Although food satisfaction, play, and humor, along with periodic sex indulgence, were means of self-gratification, it remains a fact that the evolving mores have failed to build any distinct institution of self-gratification. And it is due to this failure to evolve specialized techniques of pleasurable enjoyment that all human institutions are so completely shot through with this pleasure pursuit. Property accumulation is becoming an instrument for augmenting all forms of self-gratification, while marriage is often viewed only as a means of pleasure. And this overindulgence, this widely spread pleasure mania, now constitutes the greatest threat that has ever been leveled at the social evolutionary institution of family life, the home. The violet race introduced a new and only imperfectly realized characteristic into the experience of humankind, the play instinct, coupled with the sense of humor. It was there in measure in the Sangics and Andonites, but the Adamic strain elevated this primitive propensity into the potential of pleasure, a new and glorified form of self-gratification. The basic type of self-gratification, aside from appeasing hunger, is sex gratification. And this form of sensual pleasure was enormously heightened by the blending of the Sangics and the Andites. There is real danger in the combination of restlessness, curiosity, adventure, and pleasure abandon characteristic of the post-Andite races. The hunger of the soul cannot be satisfied with physical pleasures. The love of home and children is not augmented by the unwise pursuit of pleasure. Though you exhaust the resources of art, color, sound, rhythm, music, and adornment of person, you cannot hope thereby to elevate the soul or to nourish the spirit. Vanity and fashion cannot minister to home building and child culture. Pride and rivalry are powerless to enhance the survival qualities of succeeding generations. Advancing celestial beings all enjoy rest and the ministry of the reversion directors. All efforts to obtain wholesome diversion and to engage in uplifting play are sound. Refreshing sleep, rest, recreation, and all pastimes which prevent the boredom of monotony are worthwhile. Competitive games, storytelling, and even the taste of good food may serve as forms of self-gratification. When you use salt to savor food, pause to consider that for almost a million years, man could obtain salt only by dipping his food in ashes. Let man enjoy himself. Let the human race find pleasure in 1,001 ways. Let evolutionary mankind explore all forms of legitimate self-gratification. The fruits of the long upward biologic struggle man has well earned some of his present day joys and pleasures, but look you well to the goal of destiny. Pleasures are indeed suicidal if they succeed in destroying property, which has become the institution of self-maintenance. And self-gratifications have indeed cost a fatal price if they bring about the collapse of marriage, the decadence of family life, and the destruction of the home. Man's supreme evolutionary acquirement and civilization's only hope of survival. Presented by the Chief of Seraphim stationed on your rancher.
Mm. There's some pretty strong words there at the end.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, let's just talk about one. Let's just talk about one one development in that is a pet peeve of mine, so I'll get on a soapbox. But the idea of now having legitimized the advertising of gambling and sports betting as a form of seeking pleasure and diversion, and the endorphin rush and whatever that people get from that. I mean, this is if you've ever talked to people that have gambling addictions, my goodness gracious.
Mm-hmm.
The harm that has done to marriage,
and that does
family.
Destroy families. Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
It destroys property directly.
Yeah.
Directly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean that is a pernicious blight on our society right now, and I'm really concerned about where this is going. The fact that you can't. I mean, if I tune into a newscast, into a local newscast at 10 o'clock at night, I'm probably going to see 3 or 4 different sports betting advertisements. I mean, it's just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's as pervasive as political ads during campaign season, only it's not campaign season. And especially around the Super Bowl, they're estimating that there's something on the order. I can't remember, was it $6 billion or $76 billion? I don't know how much is riding on the Super Bowl. Okay? I mean, $6.7 or $7.6 billion minimum is what has been bet by various people around the world on the outcome of the Super Bowl. That's just the Super Bowl. That's a lot of people's homes and livelihoods that will be affected. And marriage and marriages and family life that's going to be affected by that.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, Perry on the board said, I'm having a hard time in imagining an institution of self-gratification. And I agree. That struck me too, Perry, when we read that. I thought, okay, what is an institution of self-gratification? And then they tell us that that property is an institution of self-maintenance, right? Destroying property, which has become the institution of self-maintenance. So what then would be the institution of self-gratification? And they hint at it, of course, play. You know, I personally notice that the older I get, the more joyful I am in simple things, like going on a walk with the dogs, you know. It's just wonderful. Yeah. Maybe those are the kinds of things that they're talking about where, you know, family game night, for instance. What a great institution of self-gratification that would be, where families play together. And I've also noticed that when, like, my kids come over and we all sit and chat and reminisce and laugh, and when we play a game together, like cards, I noticed, Andre, you had a great video of your family playing Jenga together. We just have the best time. The joy is absolutely, it just comes from your heart. And it is so gratifying and joyful to spend time with the people you love. And while you're playing, funny situations come up, and it makes you laugh. And we don't need to wonder how good laughter is for all of us, you know. So, yeah, it's interesting what that institution might be. I'd be interested to hear what you guys think about that.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that's kind of evolved or emerged since the book was printed, I'm trying to think of things that are sort of new. Maybe
yeah.
this isn't entirely new, but music festivals have become huh? sort of like that. Or,
yeah.
Large numbers of people, they just gather for a few days and they hang out and have the time, listen to music. I mean,
be together.
It isn't always quite so idyllic, but at its best, let's say. And it's all kinds of music, too. There's country music festivals,
yeah.
rock festivals. There's others, too, maybe even classical festivals. I don't know, but. That kind of idea of doing outdoor festivals, I think, of all kinds, is kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, that is an interesting one.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's always so much fun,
More pervasive and accepted, it would be like that. Well, during the turn of the last century, something that Dr. Sadler and some of the people early associated with the Urantia movement were part of what was called the Chautauqua movement. And the Chautauqua movement, based and named after Chautauqua, New York, was a movement whereby people would get together for quote unquote vacation, but also, for intellectual self-betterment. And people would deliver lectures while people were on holiday and talk about things, and it could be on, whatever. It could be on health. It could be on
psychology.
Many other kinds of things.
Dr. Sadler was one of those lecturers.
Yeah.
And he was one of those lecturers, exactly.
Yeah.
And of course, we have that represented here in Colorado with the Chautauqua Park, which still
mm-hmm.
has the old cabins, that are
and
still
lived in. And the auditorium.
And the auditorium there, the Chautauqua Auditorium, where people would have been delivering those kinds of lectures back around the turn mm-hmm. of the previous century. And
maybe even Sadler
it
himself.
It still has some of that kind. Yeah, he may have come there. He may have come there as
I
part
bet
of
he
the
did.
Chautauqua circuit. Yeah.
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 That's interesting.
So now
too.
Anyway,
that's a good point.
TED Talks is sort of like that.
Yeah.
Sort of.
TED Talks have become like that.
A little bit.
Right. The National Institute of Storytellers and Public Speaking, Toastmasters, is, an educational quasi, but also a form of self-gratification that way. What does it do? Is it maintaining anything? Is it perpetuating anything? Maybe educationally
mm-hmm.
and leadership wise, but
mm-hmm.
largely it has elements of great self gratification, especially during contest season where right now
mm-hmm.
people are delivering their speeches, in competitions and going on to the next level to strive to get to the world championship of public speaking, which is it's pretty remarkable. Club I belong
how gratifying.
To has the distinction of having produced one of those world champion in the year 2000.
Wow.
And
wow,
yeah.
that's a claim to fame.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great claim.
Well,
to
in
follow.
Terms.
Oh.
Yeah.
In terms of family, one of the things they do mention in a previous, I think we read it in this study, is returning to the family council practices or the, of the Andites. And I guess another aspect of that is just the simple joy of being together and meeting. Even if you don't have a council or, even if you don't have issues to work through, let's say, the fact that you just set out regular time to just be together, where everybody can talk and share, mm-hmm. and you know.
Well, ideally, dinner time would be that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's an institution right there.
That's
yeah.
Right. I wanted to add something to what you're saying about people getting together to do fun things. In my study of the late 19th century, you know, because those images I've been working on, one of the things that was interesting to read about or to learn about is the culture of that time. You know, there are no movies, there's no television, you know, there's no electronic entertainment available, right? So it was all kind of DIY, do it yourself. So in that period, there's this whole thing about parlor games. Have you heard of parlor games?
And
that was a huge fad in the 19th century. It was parlor games. So where people from the neighborhood would all get together at somebody's house, and they'd play these crazy games. And you could go, you know, online and learn about them. But some of them are just like, just kind of shake your head. But along with that, you know, was the idea of chamber music, too. You know, people who could play music, you know, they'd all get together at somebody's house. And the whole thing about salons, that was another thing, you know, where people get together talk about ideas. So there was parlor games, chamber music, and salons. All three of those combined, in some cases, to produce a very rich palette of experiences that could be shared within the community. And when you think about
it, you really get to know others that way.
How kind of civilized that is.
True.
You know, compared to like everybody just sitting around watching the television or something. You get this kind of wistful feeling of like, wow. You know, it's not sort of like the section we're just reading. I mean, it's kind of like a warning. You know, don't give up the better thing. Just out of the lures of the next bright, shiny, whatever it is. You know, not to say that, like, you know, watching TV can be fun sometimes, but the engagement dimension of it. You know, like if you're standing in front of your neighbors, right, you're going to, like, give a little lecture in the salon about something you think you know something about, right? You know, you're kind of on the spot. You know, it's like public speaking. You've got to kind of grow into taking on that role. Assuming you're not like a professional or something, right? We're just like the neighborhood trying to entertain itself, essentially, through these, you know, just gatherings in people's homes. And it's just like, it's almost unimaginable now. I mean, there are maybe some similar things. I mean, Angie and her research about how we gather, you know, that whole thing, you know, like dinner party was one of the groups that she identified or her team identified as a kind of a thing, you know, it's a sort of, where people
gather around
people
food
over for dinner, essentially.
But
it's kind of structured and organized in a way that perpetuates itself and where you get to know people and all of that.
Well, and we certainly love to do that. We
yeah,
certainly love
right.
to gather around food. Do you get the sense that the angel that wrote this paper is trying to warn us against sex indulgence? I mean, all of these papers really about marriage, kind of you know, as a I don't know, as not to be overly obsessed with that. As a form of self gratification.
Well, certainly they're trying to get us not to be obsessed with it to such an extent that we go outside of marriage to get it. But they at the same time say that it's too bad that what we've done is those that are outside of marriage are shut out of that. And what do they mean by the evolution of distinctive institutions of self-gratification, since, you know, it's not just food, but there are so many other ways that people are gratified. The original sense of an institution of self-gratification was vanity, was this idea of personal adornment. you know, but imagining that evolving to a, you know, the level of a distinctive institution is difficult. Also, imagining how all forms of gratification might be incorporated into that, especially when it involves sex gratification, that's a little tricky. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this, remember, the chief of seraphim is a superneraphim. So they have that view from paradise that they're somehow trying to imbue us with the idea that they have a perspective that is coming from there and trying to get us to look at the long picture. What could evolve that would then allow the institutions of self-maintenance and self-perpetuation to become, for lack of a better term, more pure in their objectives, less shot through with self-gratification? Like, for instance, I'll think of industry, okay? Let's just think of the institution of industry. There is a lot in most people's work of trying to find a way to make it fun. You know, whether it be hanging around the water cooler, whether it be making sure to celebrate people's birthdays at work, maybe, you know, doing all kinds of things, versus the idea of really focusing on industry and trying to make it as short as possible and get the production done so you could make, you know, the most amount of money in the shortest amount of time so that you could get on to other institutions. Our institutions are so segregated and siloed in our society that we don't think properly in terms of how they should all be functioning together. You know, why should all institutions be so focused on making money for the corporation that we're all beholden to the corporation making our own money, usually not nearly at the level we can to not have to spend more and more of our time there, at least in American society, you know, and really the direction that the society wants to go in, because, I mean, you can tell, why does the society want to go in that direction? The society wants to go in that direction because its leaders all go in that direction. Those that amass wealth do so with a view to increasing, not decreasing, their leisure time. That seems to be the social good. That seems to be the norm. And what, you know, if they use it for good purpose, that's great. But the point is that if it's good for them, why is it not good for everybody else? Why is it not good for the common man and woman who are of less means not to have the time to, for instance, invest in their families and to have good family time? Now you have situations where people have to work, you know, two jobs. It used to be that it was a struggle for women's rights for women to get out and have, you know, a job. Well, unfortunately, what has ended up happening, it's been a great thing that now, you know, women and men are more equal in the workplace, and, you know, it still has to get toward greater equality, greater parity. But one of the things that's happened as a maybe an unforeseen result, not unforeseen to everybody, is that looked at as a necessary right has now become more or less of a necessity for families in order to make it, because of how expensive life has gotten as a result of getting used to the norm, two people working in the home. And now, instead of making that be something that can allow people to lift themselves up out of their poverty, it tends to keep them in poverty, especially when one or the other can't work for whatever reason. It's really,
right.
It's really, and not to mention what it does to destroy family life when people can't have the time together that they need for family life.
Right, and children can't count on a parent being there for them when they come home. And, you know, what you were saying reminds me of my own childhood, that my dad every year would save money. He would sell tickets to the policeman's ball so he could raise extra money to take us on a vacation. And that was so important to him. That was so important to him, and he did it every year. He sold tickets to the policeman's ball. He raised some extra money, and he took us all on a wonderful family vacation. And they weren't extravagant by any means. It was maybe a road trip to California, or it was we'd go up to Glenwood, or we'd go explore somewhere in Colorado. But we went every year. He made it a point. And I will never forget any of those. That's what's so amazing to me. I think back on my life because I have done that with my family. I have made that a priority in my family, that we get to go off together somewhere on an adventure and do something that's really fun. And we don't have any responsibility except just the job of having fun today and exploring something, right? And you never forget those times. I never forget the family vacations I've taken. And it's not wasted at all. That effort, the effort that he expended to do that was very valuable to me. And it was in those times that I got to know him in a way that I wouldn't when he was just doing his work-a-day life. You know, he taught me how to fish. I'll never forget when I was 7, we sat on a pier in Twin Lakes, Colorado, and we used to go and stay at Hennessy's Cabins, and he taught me how to fish sitting out on that pier, and bless his heart, he would bait my hook, and we'd throw it out, and I'd catch a fish, and he spent his whole time baiting my hook and taking fish off of my hook because I was knocking them dead. That's when he taught me to fish. But he joyfully did that. He joyfully did that. He was having as much fun as I was. And, you know, you just can't ever forget that. So that's, you know, the family vacation is maybe a little piece of that family institution. That, what, to your point, Andre, often wealthy families get to do that, but hardworking families do not. They just, sometimes they're working their butts off just to make ends meet. And let alone say, you know, it's hard enough to pay for clothes and food and heat and car and all of the needful things, and there's no money left over for a family vacation, which is over and above all of that. You know, those
well, you consider real estate prices, you know, today, and the speculative nature of real estate, you know, the way that started evolving already in the 60s and said, well, probably long before that, but it started to become a trend among not just, you know, people that had traditionally invested in real estate, but people that learned from that and decided, well, I could make some money doing that too. Now, there's nothing wrong with people wanting to make money, but the idea that this took off as a large trend has had the effect of raising real estate prices to the point where, you know, those of us that have been alive for a little while, okay, can remember our parents buying houses that were in the neighborhood of $13,000 and $15,000 and $17,000 and $20,000. And that was the cost of a home. And, of course, you know, a dollar bought considerably less back then. But a dollar doesn't doesn't buy so much considerably more than an average home price today of around $400,000 in the big metropolitan areas, and much more in places like San Francisco, Seattle, Toronto, Vancouver, London,
Boulder,
England.
Boulder,
yeah. Well, I was moving last year from the home that I'd lived in for 7 years, and I heard, oh, there's a condo coming available across the street. Well, I knew I wasn't going to be able to afford it. I just didn't know to what extent I couldn't afford it.
Right.
And that condo, which was like a 1,400 square foot condo in Boulder, cost $600,000. And I say, what? You know, I had underestimated and thought, well, maybe 400,000 would be, well, you know, the real estate prices there are, they have continued to be bolstered by, first of all, money that's available and money from outside of the state as well, and a real estate market that has always kept the available real estate fairly low. And that's the position that the entire United States finds itself in now. And it's only the work from home movement that has allowed people to start to consider, you know, maybe I don't want to live in these higher dollar area places. Maybe I want to just choose where I want to live, and I can work remotely from there. And so a boss of mine recently moved to Alabama because that's where, you know, her partner had work, and she could work in Colorado remotely from there. You know, that's happening all over now. People are looking to how they can maximize that by moving to places with undervalued real estate, and those places now are starting to experience the inflation of their real estate prices in the same way that Denver experienced that back in the 80s and 90s.
I actually think that's going to bring rural America back, Andre. I think that very thing is going to bring a lot of rural places in America back, because now people won't be tied to cities economically. They'll be able to move to places like Alabama and Louisiana and, you know, Mississippi or whatever, smaller towns, and because they'll be able to work from anywhere. And that will bring back local economies in rural America as well, because now they'll be there. They'll want to go out to dinner sometimes. They'll want to go, you know, do something fun. And that'll bring back local economies as well. And I think it's probably a really good thing. In fact, I think that's one of the blessings of the pandemic, actually. The fact that we were all forced to stay home and realized, hey, this isn't so hard to manage. And even, you know, even kids in the family, I've noticed in my daughter's family, my son-in-law works from home. The kids don't bother him. They know he's working. They're okay with it. You know, they're just happy to know he's there. They like him when he's there. So it's been a positive development
in terms of making fathers more visible. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, it isn't. What I've noticed when everybody's home, everybody's kind of doing their own thing anyway, but you know that mom and dad are just in the other room if you need them. Or you know your kids are just in the other room. To periodically get up every, you know, so often and go check on them, make sure everything's okay, it don't take any time at all. You know, people spend more time talking at the water cooler than it takes to walk in the other room and check on your kid and make sure everything's okay and then walk back to your office. And I know this is a fact because I did it for years. I worked from home for 15 years and more. Having to go back to my in-home office during the pandemic was like, okay, well, did that, been there, done that, I can do that. You know, there are lots of good reasons for having a location where everybody gathers to work, and there are lots of good reasons to meet in person, because a lot of ideas and collaboration come forth in that. But I think that's, you know, we're really taking a step toward light and life if we find a way to help families stay connected with each other and not always make work. You know, it used to be in the old days, families worked together. They worked their farm together. They worked their business together. Their work was part of their life, but they did it together. And that's partly what's been taken away from families, is that togetherness, that everyday togetherness, you know, whether they're working or playing or what, you know, they're just together in it. And work doesn't have to be such drudgery. It can be joyful. And I had my own business. I really tried to make work joyful for everybody, including the customers that came into my store and everybody that worked for me. And, you know, and that was through just a simple culture of, you know, greet them, tell them, hi, how you doing today? Start a little conversation with them. And we got to know our customers, and it became like one big family. I did that for 7 years, and they got as much out of coming into my store as I got out of them coming into my store. So, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to change a culture.
I wonder
if you just...
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chuck.
I wonder if we could go back to paragraph 3.
Sure.
Sure.
There's something really interesting in
I think it's worthy examination.
Yeah, let me just read that whole paragraph again. It says, the violet race introduced a new and only imperfectly realized characteristic into the experience of humankind, the play instinct coupled with the sense of humor. It was there in Mazur and the Sangiks and Andonites that the Adamic strain elevated this primitive propensity into the potential of pleasure in italics. So potential pleasure, that's the thing I'm curious about. A new and glorified form of self-gratification. The basic type of self-gratification, aside from appeasing hunger, is sex gratification. And this form of sensual pleasure was enormously heightened by the blending of the Sangiks and Andites. So this propensity, or, well, the primitive propensity was, I say, elevated or evolved into this thing they're calling the potential of pleasure. So to me, that sounds like the capacity to anticipate pleasure or, you know, fantasize about pleasure. You know, your mind to be taken over thinking about potential pleasures, right?
How joyful that will be.
To such an extent that you don't think about anything else. And almost as if that has become a form of self-gratification in itself. I don't know. At least that's sort of what I'm getting from that. And that's what part of what makes, you know, there's danger associated with that. Particularly, you know, when you throw in the powerful nature of the sex urge. There's a comment in paper 82 where they say that 82, section 1, paragraph 10, which I'm sure we're all familiar with, where they say no human emotion or impulse, when unbridled and overindulged, can produce so much harm and sorrow as powerful sex urge. So keeping that in mind while reading this comment about the potential of pleasure, I think there's some connection there, that's, you know, it's kind of part of the same thing, this danger that they're warning us about repeatedly.
Go ahead and finish that paragraph, though, because it's so important. And, you know, it's funny, I had that one called up too, Chuck. I had that very paragraph called up.
Okay, I'll just read the rest of it. Yeah, then they say, this is still 82.110, intelligent submission of this impulse to the regulations of society is the supreme test of the actuality of any civilization. And we remember, we just read about civilization's only hope is survival. So this is connected again, I think. It's the supreme test of the actuality of any civilization. Self-control, more and more self-control, is the ever-increasing demand of advancing mankind. Secrecy, insincerity, and hypocrisy may obscure sex problems, but they do not provide solutions, nor do they advance ethics. That's another one. It's like,
there's so much in that paragraph, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, these are like moral instruction, if you think about it.
Right.
They're trying to give us some moral teaching here, which I think is very important. I mean, where else do we get, you know,
well, almost a scientific underpinning for moral instruction in a certain sense, saying, this is the experience you'll have if you do thus and so. If you overindulge, you know, the sex appetite, there's nothing that causes more problems for marital relationships and, you know,
harm and sorrow.
Everything requires self-control. It's not just that, of course. You know, you can turn anything into an addiction or an overindulgence. Yeah.
Especially those things that give you pleasure, as we see with, you know, everything, actually. You know, if it gives you pleasure, it can be overindulged.
So this capacity to imagine pleasure, which I think is maybe what they're talking about here, comes from this Adamic strain that includes all these other good things, including sense of humor and everything else. But there's also this capacity to imagine pleasure that maybe wasn't so much a part of the earlier racial, you know, types. So not only is there concern about the thing itself, if it's an overindulgence, but then there's also the imagining the overindulgence right before it happens, or even if it doesn't happen. And that's a whole sort of another, you know, problem area, potentially. I mean, I don't know, so many people. I mean, I think it's interesting how Jesus somewhere, he's talking about the sex urge and telling the apostles, look, just teach, you know, keep your teaching positive. You know, the prohibitions in the sensual area, I don't forget how he said this exactly, but this is like a no-win attempt, you know, to try and regulate people's moral behavior through laws or even religious rulings. You know, people are going to do what they do, and they have to, on their own, kind of get a moral perspective where they can achieve this sort of self-control because they know it's going to produce something better. You know, he talks about that. You know, if you have to replace your lower urges, if you want to call them that, with a higher desire that then dominates, and you realize, well, if I do this thing, that's going to take away from my progress toward this higher thing. And then that's when we get a real kind of a stronger motivation around it, rather than just, you know, trying to enforce self-denial just as a force of will. But that doesn't really work. And somewhere in there, he talks about, it comes up somewhere in the book, they talk about how this sex urge has to be powerful in order to guarantee the propagation of the race. It has to be very powerful. And it's by design that it's very powerful. And it's for that reason, for that purpose. And there's some sympathy almost, like, okay, we understand we put this thing in you that's going to be really hard to manage,
right?
Because it's so powerful. And so they give us warnings, but they don't exactly berate us. You know what I mean? It's a compassionate plea, you might say.
Our job to learn
that this is that this is very difficult for us, and it's difficult
right
because of the purpose it was designed for. So we have this sort of collateral damage from the results from this building in of these strong urges that have to be there to propagate the race. But the collateral damage is like that there's so much of this, you know, the self-gratification aspect that goes along with it that makes it hard for us to manage.
I think I mentioned last week or maybe the week before Jesus and Gannon down by the Citadel. And the two prostitutes came up, right? And we're talking about, you know, the sex urge and how it becomes, you know, harmful, let's say, which is what you're saying. And I'd just like to read what he says to Gannett about that, because it bears in what you're saying. This is from paper 133, section 3, paragraph 7. It says, as they stood there in the moonlight, Jesus went on to say, this is, he said it to Gannett, and the two women are standing there as well, there lives within every human mind a divine spirit, the gift of the Father in heaven. This good spirit ever strives to lead us to God, to help us to find God and to know God. But also within mortals, there are many natural physical tendencies which the Creator put there to serve the well-being of the individual and the race. Now, oftentimes, men and women become confused in their efforts to understand themselves and to grapple with the manifold difficulties of making a living in a world so largely dominated by selfishness and sin. I perceive, Gannett, that neither of these women is willfully wicked. I can tell by their faces that they have experienced much sorrow. They have suffered much at the hands of an apparently cruel fate. They have not intentionally chosen this sort of life. They have, in discouragement bordering on despair, surrendered to the pressure of the hour and accepted this distasteful means of obtaining a livelihood as the best way out of a situation that to them appeared hopeless. Gannett, some people are really wicked at heart. They deliberately choose to do mean things. But tell me, as you look into these now tear-stained faces, do you see anything bad or wicked? And Jesus paused for his reply. Gannett's voice choked up as he stammered out his answer. No, teacher, I do not. And I apologize for my rudeness to them. I crave their forgiveness. Then said Jesus, and I bespeak for them that they have forgiven you as I speak for my Father in heaven that he has forgiven them. Now all of you come with me to a friend's house where we will seek refreshment and plan for a new and better life ahead. It's not only, you know, to identify that there's a problem, but to understand the gravity of it, to understand how pervasive it is. And he did. He understood it. And and when he said, you know, now oftentimes men and women become confused in their efforts to understand themselves and to grapple with the manifold difficulties of making a living in a world so largely dominated by selfishness and sin. And self-gratification in that regard can become very selfish. You know?
Well,
I mean,
right.
That's why it can become so harmful. Perhaps as the quote you read, Chuck, perhaps one of the more harmful things that we have to learn to manage and control. And, you know, how we do that is our issue to figure out. I'm not sure how that can be done, especially in this age of the Internet. But
Well, to go along with that, I found this other comment that he made that I was referring to. It's interesting to sort of pair these up to see how they kind of relate to each other. This is in 140, paper 140, section 8, paragraph 21, where they say that Jesus had little to say about the social vices of his day. Seldom did he make reference to moral delinquency. He was a positive teacher of true virtue. He studiously avoided the negative method of imparting instruction. He refused to advertise evil. He was not even a moral reformer. He well knew, and so taught his apostles, that the sensual urges of mankind are not suppressed by either religious rebuke or legal prohibitions. If few denunciations were largely directed against pride, cruelty, oppression, and hypocrisy. So that's kind of a worldly wisdom perspective. You know, you think about, you know, they talk about the Salem missionaries, you know, made the mistake of trying to be moral reformers, and it caused, in some cases, the failure of their enterprise. So that's a, you know, he's almost like he's, you know, obviously he understands all that. But when they say he was not even a moral reformer, if you look at that in perspective of what happened to some of the Salem missionaries, you know, it makes sense that that would be the case. Because if you're trying to impart a spiritual message and you go too far into the moral realm, you're going to, you know, people are going to get mad at you because they like their indulgences, you know. So that's got to be careful going into that territory. So he just avoided it altogether from the sound of this. Anyway.
Well, I don't know that he was necessarily avoiding it.
Put forward a positive demonstration.
Right. A positive
of true virtue.
Of
true virtue. And that's the powerful. That's, you know, that's what we need. That's what we need. We need somebody to set an example, which he did. So
right.
I'm not saying he ignored the issue in that sense.
No. And I'm not. Yeah. I'm actually not even focusing on that aspect. I think what he understood implicitly was the idea that if he had focused on any of those things, they would have undermined his being able to teach a pure spiritual message. He knew
right.
that what would make more greater difference rather in morality and politics and economics and in the social sphere, those four spheres that everybody look at trying to affect directly, he knew that the greatest way to affect those things was to get people to spiritually grow. Mm-hmm. That part of the problem with morality is that so much of it becomes stultified. It becomes whatever was taught in the past is the morality of the present and should be the morality of the future. And I think we're seeing today, for instance, particularly, that the morality of the past, the cookie-cutter morality is how I like to think of it, doesn't cook the right cut the right kind of cookies anymore. How do you talk about an ethics or morality, for instance, of how to design a self-driving car, which needs to make a determination if it's going to hit one person or three people, which direction it should steer.
Oh, my God.
That's a certain kind of morality and ethical problem that hasn't appeared on the stage of human civilization before, not in that form. How do you design a mechanism that will deal with that ethical and moral problem? Well, you have to have spiritually growing people to be able to think about those things correctly when there is new science that has to be composed with the inner life of people to come up with new dynamic moral situations and problems. These problems haven't been solved. And the cookie-cutter morality, thou shalt not kill, doesn't solve that problem. Because there are certain cases where you can't avoid it. I mean,
right.
in that instance.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
Yeah, good point. I mean, nobody ever said our problems aren't complex, right? They are. And here's another, along this line, Andre, what you're saying, here's another interesting quotation from paper 136, 610. It's about Jesus' decisions, his great decisions. This great decision of Jesus portrays dramatically the truth that selfish satisfaction and sensuous gratification alone and of themselves are not able to confer happiness upon evolving human beings. There are higher values in mortal existence, which kind of goes to paragraph 3 that we read, Chuck. There are higher values in mortal existence, intellectual mastery and spiritual achievement, which far transcend the necessary gratification of man's purely physical appetites and urges. Man's natural endowment of talent and ability should be chiefly devoted to the development and ennoblement of his higher powers of mind and spirit. This book is just so full of clues that
mm-hmm.
we should be
yeah.
focusing on, right?
Yeah.
Here, no,
yeah.
don't focus on this, focus on that. And that's what we're talking about, Andre, you once pointed
right.
out that, seek first the kingdom and all things needful shall be added. Whereas if you seek the lesser, the kingdom will be excluded, which is the greatest joy, the ability to
yeah.
develop and help your children develop noble ways to spend their time, empowering ways, enlightening ways to spend their time, rather than
mm-hmm.
base ways of just
yeah.
material
mm-hmm.
appetites and gratification, right? I mean, not that those things shouldn't
yeah.
happen. We all enjoy a great meal. We all love Thanksgiving. I can't tell you how many men I know that's their favorite holiday. That is their by far
uh-huh.
their favorite holiday.
Just
they
men?
Look forward to it all
just
year.
Men?
Yeah. Well, no, I've just noticed that women really like Christmas a lot, and men really love, and this is just in my little realm of being, the people I've met and whatever, men really like Thanksgiving.
Sure.
So to join around
interesting.
A great meal, most of the men I know prefer Thanksgiving to any other holiday just by
yeah.
virtue of the
yeah.
fact that the food is superb usually, and it's just so gratifying to sit down and
yeah.
eat that amazing meal with the people you love nearby.
Uh-huh.
There's something about it. And
that's an example of bringing other values into play along
right.
with the pleasure of food. So it's not
right.
just about the pleasure of food, but that's kind of the vehicle
no.
that brings everybody in. There's
it wouldn't be nearly as pleasurable if there wasn't anyone else there to share it with you, right?
Yeah, right.
It wouldn't
right.
mean much at
yeah.
all, but it's the fact that you're
yeah.
all doing it together. Go ahead. Sorry, Chuck.
There's this one part that's also, I'm sure, familiar, but I think it's relevant to what we're reading, where Jesus talks about temptation. He's asked by the apostles about temptation. And I think temptation is almost synonymous with this potential of pleasure we were just reading about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, at least that's kind of how I understand it.
Yes.
And,
maybe it is exactly
here,
that.
Yeah, I think so, and that's why he's giving the instruction here on how to cope with it.
Right.
And this is in paper 156, section 5, and I'm just going to pick it up about halfway through paragraph 4 and then go through paragraph 5. So down around the middle of paragraph 4, he says, well, maybe two-thirds of the way down, he says, "You know that men are all too often led into temptation by the urge of their own selfishness and by the impulses of their animal natures." So you easily understand that. We all can, I think. "When you are in this way tempted, I admonish you that while you recognize temptation honestly and sincerely for just what it is, you intelligently redirect the energies of spirit, mind, and body, which are seeking expression, into higher channels and toward more idealistic goals. In this way, may you transform your temptations into the highest types of uplifting mortal ministry, while you almost wholly avoid those wasteful and weakening conflicts between the animal and spiritual natures that tends to go on, you know, within all of this, particularly given this heady racial mix, you know, with the Andites blending in with the Sanghics, but incompletely and all that. But then he goes on to say, but let me warn you against the folly of undertaking to surmount temptation by the effort of supplanting one desire by another and supposedly superior desire through the mere force of the human will.
Wow, yeah.
So that kind of ties in directly what he was saying to the apostles in that other place where he says, you know, religious rebuke and everything. Yeah, forget it. It's not going to happen. You know, it's just, anyway. So here he puts it in terms of the mere force of the human will. And he goes on to say, if you would be truly triumphant over the temptations of the lesser and lower nature, you must come to that place of spiritual advantage where you have really and truly developed an actual interest in and love for those higher and more idealistic forms of conduct which your mind is desirous of substituting for these lower and less idealistic habits of behavior that you recognize as temptation. You will, in this way, be delivered through spiritual transformation rather than be increasingly overburdened with the deceptive suppression of mortal desires. The old and the inferior will be forgotten in the love for the new and the superior. Beauty is always triumphant over ugliness in the hearts of all who are illuminated by the love of truth. There is mighty power in the expulsive energy of a new and sincere spiritual affection. And again, I say to you, be not overcome by evil, but rather overcome evil with good. So,
and he gives a very practical way to do that, right?
Yeah, almost pragmatic. Say, look, this is going to happen. This is what you do. You know?
Right.
Don't be surprised by this. Look at this for exactly what it is. Yeah,
right.
I like how he puts it that way.
When you're tempted,
well,
you can actually do something, you know, reason with yourself.
You have to recognize that. Yeah,
right.
You have to recognize it for what it is. So they talk, he says, that you recognize as temptation.
Mm-hmm. That's an amazing teaching. I'm so glad you found that because I was trying to find it earlier and I couldn't. I couldn't remember the key word.
It's an important one.
Yeah.
It's kind of the handshake to the what we were just reading about the dangers of self-gratification. This is like, okay, this is the sort of the solution or at least a practical approach to that problem.
Right.
Which is, we should expect. I mean, it's kind of built into us. You know, like that other thing you brought up, which is, you know, the Father has planted these, you know, this within you for a purpose. But
right.
You have to, yeah.
But it can control you. And oftentimes, you know, I mean, I think we're all tempted, right? We're all tempted by one thing or another. And let's say we're, you know, one of the biggies is you're in a relationship, you're married, you have a family. Men and women are both tempted by this to let their heart out to play with some other consenting adult, right, within that family. Or not within the family, but outside the family, but while they are still an active member of their own family, to stray, to go and do something that they should, they know they probably shouldn't do. And you, you either talk yourself into it or you talk yourself out of it, right? And one of the things that, and I think most people do this, I think they rationalize. And one of the keys, I think, is if you have to rationalize, you probably shouldn't do it. You know, that would be your first red mm-hmm. flag, the very fact that you have to rationalize it somehow.
No, what's the difference between rationalizing and, I don't know.
Here's the yeah. mental exercise that I've gone through in my life. Mm-hmm. That would feel good in the moment. Whatever it is, doesn't have to be infidelity. It could be anything, right? Anything you know is uh-huh. wrong, but you think it would feel good anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that would feel good in the moment, but, and then I count the cost. Literally, in my heart and my mind, I say, what would be the cost of this? Yeah, just mm-hmm. suppose that this came to light, that you did this thing. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, whether you got caught, and what would happen if you didn't get caught, you'd be tempted to do it again. And sooner or later, you'll probably get caught. And then what would be the ramifications of all of that? Who would, and what I especially, you know, the way that I count the cost myself is I think, okay, who would be hurt by that? Who would I hurt by that? And how badly would they be hurt? And what would be the ramifications in their lives of my little moment of self-indulgence, you know, whatever it is, which would mm-hmm. be a momentary mm-hmm. pleasure. But what would be the real ramifications of all the people that I know and love?
Mm-hmm.
And that thought immediately mm-hmm. quells, honestly, it immediately quells the temptation mm-hmm. for me, because I couldn't bear to hurt anybody. I couldn't bear to hurt anybody, and especially not the people I love. I couldn't bear mm-hmm. it. That would be, you know, that would put me in a situation where I would find it very hard to forgive myself. And I don't mm-hmm. want to be in that position, right? So that's effective for me as a mental exercise, to count the cost of whatever little self-indulgence is tempting me, you know.
Mm-hmm. And well, the positive side of that is the integrity of those relationships.
Well, right.
You know, that there's this higher purpose in play. And if you recognize that, not wanting to hurt other people, that's a big one. But then there's also yeah. not wanting to hurt the project, kind of, or what's being created within the family.
Right.
As a culture and as a quality relationship and all that.
Not to rip the fabric, the very fabric of what that family
not
is.
To,
which
sometimes
we think, oh, that's not a big deal. That would be no big, you know, thing. But
right.
it can turn
right.
into a big thing. So
of course, but then what if you're like in a bad marriage or a marriage that's gone bad, you know?
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Trying to hold it together. But you know, you just kind of reach this dead end where, you know, divorces happen a lot. You know, I never thought I'd be divorced. Here I am. You know, it's like, and then naturally you're going to think about, well, okay.
Doing other things, right.
Yeah,
right.
Or whatever. Maybe my compatibility with the partner is somehow diminished. And
I think that's where mornings come in.
Sometimes you can rescue it. Sometimes you can rescue, you know, a family relationship. But
I think mores
really
are good in that regard. I think mores would help you say, okay, so the more is that, you know, you don't begin a new relationship until you've closed off this one. If that's the intent, if
yeah.
you really feel like you need to close this relationship mm-hmm. down, that this relationship isn't serving
yeah,
you, you take care
good.
Of that business first. And then you engage in a new relationship. That would
be
like,
the
you know, the social
yeah.
dictate or, yeah, the honorable way to manage that. But you're right. It doesn't
yeah.
always happen that way. And I don't think people
right.
can choose, you know, passion. Sometimes they just get it hits them squarely between the eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's right. Can be overwhelming. But yeah.
Well,
it's interesting.
This imagination gets in there too.
Yeah.
You know, the potential of pleasure thing.
Watch out for the great potential of pleasure.
Right.
Because,
the whole dopamine thing. It's huge in all this.
It's like when you walk by a bakery and you see them. You see the most sumptuous, delicious baked goods, you know, like a big chocolate cake or a Bismarck or something you absolutely know will taste fabulous. And the self-control it takes not to indulge that temptation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when it presents itself, it's very real. That's why it's a temptation, mm-hmm. right? It's a very
right.
real possibility.
But
and
then
the
you think about,
how
am I going to feel after I eat that?
Right.
What's
exactly.
that going to do to my blood glucose levels or whatever?
And my desire to have more and more and more.
Right.
Yeah. So,
anyway.
Yeah, these problems are real, and it's delightful to talk to you guys about them, and I think the Arantia book presents them in the way it does, just so we can, we can bring them to light and, you know, discuss them and bring new understandings to them. You know, I think that goes to that keep secrecy and, you know, you just can't keep this stuff secret. It'll tear you apart if you do. You have to have a discourse on our humanness and be able to, you know, reasonably discover it and find ways to manage it and deal with it. Were you going to say something, Andre? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt
you. Well, I was just going to say, you're the devil. You got me thinking about that pastry shop at 92nd and Sheridan. So I wouldn't have been thinking about that if it weren't for you.
You're going to run out there. Like,
of course, we always project our foibles onto others. So...
is there a good pastry shop at 92nd and Sheridan?
Oh, there is. Are you kidding?
Know.
In that same parking lot with H Mart. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yes, there is. I have seen that one.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Now I got you thinking about it.
Yeah, well,
so
I know of several around. Talking about it is one thing. Seeing it, having an opportunity to walk up and buy it right now in this moment, that's another level of temptation.
Yeah, it's your potential pleasure kicking. Yeah. I thought there was something interesting.
Go ahead, Chuck. Well, I was just going to mention paragraph 5.
Yeah,
so, you know, where they say, advancing celestial beings all enjoy rest and the ministry of the reversion director, so, you know, humor and reversion, all efforts to obtain wholesome diversion and to engage in uplifting play are sound, refreshing sleep, rest, recreation, and all pastimes which prevent the boredom of monotony are worthwhile. Competitive games, storytelling, and even the taste of good food may serve as forms of self-gratification. And then they tell us about salt, how, you know, primitives had to dip their food in ash to obtain a salty flavor. But I think this is great because they give us, you know, some great examples, competitive games, storytelling, and even the taste of food. These are all good forms. And then they go to this next section where they say, let man enjoy himself. Let the human race find pleasure in 1,001 ways. Let evolutionary mankind explore all forms of legitimate self-gratification, the fruits of the long upward biologic struggle. So to me, that tells me that there's many that we're not even aware of yet. Things that we could do, which are deeply gratifying.
Well, it's also the suggestion that self-gratification is best when it's shared with others.
Right.
I mean, I think where it gets dangerous is when it becomes an isolated thing.
Right.
You know, where you're in like you're taken away by your potential pleasure and you're fantasizing about all these things, and that takes you away from other people. And the indulgence of the, whatever that temptation might be, can be, like, I remember going into casinos, like in Las Vegas, you're talking about gambling online. I mean, gambling in person, too. And you go in there, like, in the middle of the night, and you see somebody just sitting there in one of those machines. That's just sitting there and sitting there, and one drink after another, smoking like a chimney, pulling that lever one
right.
more time.
And
they're
yeah.
completely isolated. They're completely
oblivious
from everything.
Yeah.
Right. And so those kind of gratifications can be very isolating. I mean, that's just one example. But there are others.
Perry has pointed out on the board that guilt about these things can be debilitating
yes.
too. This is what she says.
Exactly.
Guilt about lower desires in favor of spiritual desires can be confused with an almost endemic need for touch, physical comfort that so many people suffer from. And then she says too many live alone, untouched and sad, which I think speaks to what you're saying. And then she went on to say a blocked capacity for experiencing pleasure can be as detrimental to health as constant fear and stress. So thank you, Perry. That's really important to remember that, you know, we need to open up to the beautiful pleasures in the world and not think of everything as being sinful just because it's good.
If we can enjoy them with others,
right.
I mean, that's the thing about marriage.
Right.
You get to enjoy sex with a partner, right?
Right.
And it can get better, with more practice. Yeah.
So just speaking of evolution of culture that way, in Japan, they have come up with these soyoneas, which are essentially cuddle cafes, which is the opportunity to sleep with someone but not have sex. You know, it's all about having contact with people.
Closeness
for that
and
important
touch,
physical
right.
affection.
Oh.
And it's the first ones have opened. There's a cost for it. It's like something like £24 UK, that would be, you know, close to $30 or $40 American or Canadian. And it's an interesting idea. So Perry's point is very, very good. How do you do that in such a way that it doesn't get confused with the idea of sexual pleasure, which is a different need, actually.
Right, it is a different need. And there's a danger of that. I can see if you get close to someone and start cuddling with them, that those desires could be aroused. You know, really,
well,
honestly.
Is the cuddler like a professional that works at the place?
A professional cuddler,
you do come in. And,
well, that's right.
You're like a client, that's what one of their professional cuddlers. Or
right.
Paired up with somebody else who comes out, off the street.
And there's even the question, is this sweet or is it sad? You know?
That
you idea
need to pay
that,
somebody to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's essentially a sleep together shop, soyoneya.
Soyoneya, huh? Interesting world we live in, isn't it? Well, what a great conversation, you guys, this has been. I loved studying this paper with you. Sorry Marvin didn't make it today. It's always so great that Marvin adds another dimension, huh? He always adds psychology. And
Yeah,
it's great. But, we carry on and we do our best when someone is gone. Andre and I are going to be gone next weekend. And, in fact, friends, we won't be doing the show next weekend. So we'll be back in 2 weeks, just so you know.
We'll put
something out. Yeah, with a new topic. So we have some time to figure out what we want to do.
Figure that out.
Right. So, hey, it's so great always to spend this time with you. And I'm glad. Thank you, Perry, for all the wonderful things you say. And Kim had to leave, I'm sure, but I'm glad Kim has been enjoying this study. And Isadora and Robert, he has a gig right now, so he won't be on the board for a while, he said. But Vaughn and Arvilla, we love you guys. So good to see you every Saturday on the board. If you ever I want to shout out, just press your one key. No time left today, I'm sorry to say, but still. But we'll be back
next time in two weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening.
All right. Yeah, indeed.
Thank you, guys. Have a great week.
All right.
See you next Saturday, Andre.
Until then.
Yeah.
You bet.
Until then.
Great
see you then. And bye for now.
Bye for now.
Sure enough. Love you guys. Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.